This is an ABC podcast.
What exactly is consciousness? That is a question humans have been pondering since forever. And you've probably heard the maxim, I think, therefore I am. It was written by French philosopher René Descartes 400 years ago, and it was a way to prove our own existence. If you think, you exist, you're conscious. That is one way of looking at things, but researchers are still debating what consciousness is 400 years later, and there are now about 20 different theories of consciousness. What I'm getting at is we are still confused about our own consciousness. So what about animals, non-human animals? Are they conscious? That question opens up a can of worms. And open that can we did at a recent All in the Mind live event at the World Science Festival in Brisbane.
Consciousness. So can I get a show of hands? Raise your hand if you think that at least some animals are probably conscious. Maybe not all of them, but at least some. Okay, that looks like most of the room. Is there anyone here who thinks animals are definitely not conscious? Any hands for that? Okay, no one. I'm not seeing any hands. All right, okay, I want to get specific. I want to know what you think about specific animals. Raise your hand if you think elephants are conscious. Okay, that looks like most of the room. Cockroaches? About kind of half-ish the room, sort of. Octopus. Oh yeah, everyone's got their hands up. Okay, final one. Fruit flies. Do you think they're conscious? Maybe a third of the room, a bit of shaking hands. Okay, not too sure on that one.
We're going to play a shorter version of that event for you today because we covered some fascinating territory in that chat. Everything from parrot intelligence to trials in medieval Europe where animals were charged with crimes.
These were animals who were trialed for crimes against humanity, either for, you know, homicides or destruction of property.
Now, you're going to hear from three experts in this episode. There's Bruno van Swinderen, who is a professor at the Queensland Brain Institute. He studies consciousness and perception in fruit flies. There's also Christina Zdenek, a biologist and science communicator at the University of Queensland. And Deborah Brown, professor of philosophy, also at the University of Queensland. And I start here by asking Deborah to at least try and define consciousness for us.
I'm not actually sure you can define consciousness. We have a lot of...
Wrong answer. We need an answer.
I mean, we have a lot of synonyms for it, like subjective awareness or subjective experience or what it's like. And not every term in science necessarily has a definition, or often if you give a definition, it just shifts the problem to, you know, explaining what the terms are in the definition. So if I say subjective awareness, what do I mean by awareness? And awareness is ambiguous. I might just mean detection in the way in which a thermostat detects something. We say the thermostat is aware of the temperature in the room, but, you know, it's not conscious, obviously. Mm. But I think, you know, the thing about consciousness as a term is that it's defined in relation to a feeling that we all experience. If you all pinch yourself right now, and if you feel pain, I'll say that's what it is to be conscious, right? And that's actually important because our term consciousness is fixed in relation to human experience. So when we extrapolate out to ask the question whether other animals are conscious, that's that's in a sense what fixes the meaning of the term.
Bruno, do you have a definition of consciousness that you work with? How would you define it?
Right, so I work on fruit flies, and it has to be something a lot simpler, right? So it can't be something that involves emotions or, you know, self-awareness. It's hard to test in a fly. But what we can test in a fly and measure in a fly's brain is what's called a prediction error. So in a way, every brain is a prediction machine, and it wants to predict the future. And I would say that most animals kind of want to, that's what they need to do. And for me, it's really about detecting prediction errors and about detecting how surprised the fly is when it makes a mistake.
Right.
And for me, consciousness operationally is keeping track of our mistakes so that we can suddenly learn something new and make new models of the world.
And so based on what you know, then can we say whether fruit flies are conscious?
I think that question has the human baggage associated with it.
Right.
It has what it needs to have to be conscious for a fly's consciousness. And we need to be, in a way, not distracted by what it would feel like to have human consciousness.
Maybe we should backtrack here for a moment, because the very idea that animals might have consciousness is a relatively modern one. René Descartes, our I think, therefore I am friend, said that animals didn't have consciousness, or they didn't have a mind. They were essentially mindless machines. When did scientists, Christina, start to think that that might not be totally correct?
Well, I guess it starts back maybe when Darwin came around and published Origin of Species. So mid-1850s, he sort of debunked the paradigm of the time that humans were at the top of the pyramid in terms of, you know, having their own mind and not just these mindless machines just reacting based on instinct. And it was just that, you know, we all actually have a common ancestor. And so with that paradigm shift, scientists started to test the consciousness and the cognition of different species. And so like come to Ivan Pavlov with his dogs and this associative learning, you know, he would notice that as soon as he would ring the bell, there was the dinner bell for the dogs, that they would start salivating. And even in the absence of food being present, if he would just ring the bell at that. So basically it was proving that the animals were learning. And so all of a sudden, well, they must have a mind because they're learning. And then, you know, throughout history, scientists got better and better at, like you said, Bruno, taking a non-human perspective and trying to think about it in terms of the species and start immersing themselves into the environment of the animal rather than just like taking them out into the lab. So you think about like Jane Goodall going and living with chimpanzees in the 1960s to better understand their social systems and their cognition. But I guess one of these tests that came around was the mirror test.
Yeah.
And that was scientists looking at whether animals are able to recognize themselves in the mirror. And scientists thought that would be a way to measure consciousness, intelligence. And so what they would do is they'd mark whilst the animal's sleeping, put a red mark on their forehead or whatever. And then as soon as they were presented with a mirror, see whether they would just like try to move it off of, you know, or try to like inspect.
And would they?
Well, it depends on the species. Mm-hmm. So dolphins can recognize themselves in the mirror. We know that. We know that chimpanzees and monkeys, but dogs, not so much. They tend to think it's another dog and start to like bark at it.
Okay.
And so, yeah, there's this variation across the tree of life and the ability of these animals to pass these tests that scientists keep trying to come up with in order to test like problem solving, self-awareness, inhibitory control, and that sort of thing.
Why? I'm wondering, why is there no single definition of consciousness? Why is this such a debated term? Why haven't we pinned down what it is?
There's 20 different theories of consciousness that people are putting forward. And I think that's just how confusing the field is. Mm. And in a way, maybe we've been relying too much on trying to figure out human consciousness. Mm. And we should be thinking about evolutionarily, why would consciousness be adaptive?
This question of animal consciousness. In 2012, Bruno, you were part of a group of international scientists that produced the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness. And in that declaration, there's a line that says, the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates that generate consciousness. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes, I mean, that was a declaration where we went through various criteria, one of them being pain, for example. Do animals self-medicate, for example, to alleviate pain? There are several criteria you can go through. And I think at that point in 2012, it kind of ended with octopus and maybe bees.
That are conscious.
That could have consciousness, so we should seriously be wondering about that and think about it in terms of how to maybe prove it or test it. And now, I mean, it's moving forward. It's like if, you know, the architecture, the neural circuits that happen in a bee's brain that make them potentially have something like metacognition, you know, are you allowed, does an animal know when it doesn't know? And opt out of an experiment, for example, because it doesn't know.
And
bees have that capacity.
Wow. Okay.
Those experiments have been done.
And bees can count.
But then those are, again, kind of anthropocentrisms, right? They're ways of thinking about consciousness in terms of how would a human think about consciousness.
Is this such a problem, though? Like, we keep coming back to this, and we have no other way to think about this. Is this really such a big problem?
I think there is another way to think about it. And it's what I mentioned earlier. What would be evolutionarily adaptive about subjective awareness? Why would having somehow a subjective experience be something that helps you survive in the world? And there are some good ideas there that somehow this makes you a better learner, that if you were unconscious and moving through space as a zombie with just a classical conditioning, for example, like Pavlov's dogs, you would not be a good learner. And it's true that, you know, consciousness is computationally expensive, but what's expensive really is making mistakes. If we are a habit-driven creature moving through the world, predicting everything perfectly, That's cheap, right? What happens, what's expensive is when we make a prediction and we made a mistake and need to somehow reevaluate and make a new model. And if you measure brain activity, then it flares up everywhere because an animal, the brain, has just made a mistake. So what's potentially interesting here is that consciousness is about making good predictions, but not over-predicting and becoming a habit-driven zombie, but predicting, being surprised enough to learn new things and kind of keeping our brains in that middle ground of making good enough predictions, but not over-predicting so that we don't learn anything new. And that is, that's adaptive, right? We have to be able to learn new things. And that was probably true for the simplest animals, for, you know, for arthropods had to do that as animals moving through space, making predictions about what they might bump into, about prey, that they had to have a subjective experience of the world, a selective attention. And flies have selective attention. We can measure that.
One issue is, though, that, you know, you can direct attention below the threshold of consciousness, right? We can do that in humans. And also,
what do you mean by that? How can we do that? What do you mean?
Oh, well, you know, so there are blind sight patients, for example, who, you know, because of some lesion in their brain are not aware, but their visual cortex is still processing information. And they can, you know, learn to make associations, even though they can't, you know, they're not aware of those associations, but their behavior will reflect that they are.
So that they might not know that they're seeing a wall in front of them, but they'll avoid it anyways because they have blind sight. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so their visual cortex is still processing information. But also, I mean, even with other animals, for example, you can ablate, that is to remove most of the brain of a fish, and you can still train it to avoid part of the tank where it will receive an electrical shock. So a lot of, you know, adaptive learning, it's slower than if you have a brain,
right.
But you can still do it, right? So wherever you can train an animal to avoid a noxious stimulus with most of its brain gone, it's hard to infer that, you know, that you need consciousness in order to learn, in order to be adaptive.
Right, because they're doing those things without...
Yeah, ain't nothing going on upstairs.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
an interesting point here too. There's these planarium worms that have been studied for a long time in terms of their neurobiology, very simple, small worms. And if you give them an experience and you show them, okay, this is where food is, for an example, and it's a bit macabre, but if you chop their heads off and you think, okay, well, the neural processing of information that's stored is in their small brain, but if you chop the heads off and they regrow another one, they still somehow remember where to go. And so they have the experience of the old head. So then it's a bit mind-blowing. And just
are they machines
worm.
Then, or are they
so where is memory stored, right. And where is this cognition happening? Is it decentralized more so than what we thought? And, you know, there's a theory that it's maybe somehow related to RNA as well.
This is All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar, and you're listening to a live show we recently recorded at the World Science Festival Brisbane with evolutionary biologist Bruno van Swinderen, science communicator Christina Zdenek, and philosopher Deborah Brown. And clearly, there is still a lot up for debate about whether certain animals are conscious and what counts as consciousness. But it's also the case that for other animals, we have quite a bit of evidence that there's probably quite a lot going on upstairs.
Interesting. I just wanted to go back to one line that's in that Cambridge Declaration that I mentioned a moment ago, because it's really striking. In that document, there's a line that reads, "Evidence of near human-like levels of consciousness have been most dramatically observed in the African grey parrot." That seems pretty big. Can you tell me about the African grey parrot?
I think maybe Christina might have a better experience with the African grey parrot.
Yeah, sure, I can talk about it. So Alex is a famous parrot that Professor Irene Pepperberg studied for over 10 years, and she revealed incredible levels of intelligence with this species in particular. And like one example, okay, the ability to count over like six or something like that, but also, you know, the time that she spent in the lab, something like 6 hours a day for over 10 years, you know, she was able to reach a level with this bird and be able to test its problem-solving ability. She taught it a language. It knew many words. It could tell colors and even texture, and was even doing behaviors like trying to deceive the trainer. And so, like, it just really started to open up people's minds in terms of the levels of intelligence and therefore, at a more basic level, consciousness that non-human animals have. And, you know, parrots and corvids, now we know, have really high levels of intelligence and roughly comparable to possibly a five-year-old child. Like, wow. If you were to put a, you know, some problem-solving ability or test in front of a five-year-old child, and the same thing with a corvid, sometimes the corvid, like a crow, does better.
Wow.
On that particular test. So where does that leave us? You know, yeah. Like we don't think that crows are more intelligent. We think that we have more complex intelligence, right. But there's like this portfolio of intelligences. There's multiple intelligences. Mm. There's a theory out there that there's like nine or so different intelligence, you know, the social intelligence, mathematical, musical, physical, you know, and you think, okay, our ability to navigate the world, think of it like a shark, electroreception, or, you know, we definitely don't have that. Mm. Echolocation of dolphins or that bats do. We certainly can't do that. So all of a sudden it's been a really interesting journey that humans have taken along our paradigm of what we are thinking in terms of where humans are, and we always want to compare it ourselves to animals. And I think the better we are at testing these different levels of consciousness and intelligence, it really puts into question our original thought that we're at the top.
It almost feels like the question is not, are animals conscious, but why do we seem to think they're not? Like, why do we have that belief at all? Did you want to try and answer that, Deb?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, as a historian of philosophy, you know, I look back at that history and I would say predominantly we have thought that animals are conscious. So you go back to the ancient Greeks and the Stoics, and they thought animals had a soul, and the Epicureans and so on. And that kind of persisted right up until Descartes. And then during Descartes' time, I mean, he was pilloried for that view that animals are machines, you know, by all his commentators and all his critics. And then afterwards, very few of his followers even subscribed to the idea that animals are machines. Mm. And then a lot of them reverted back to thinking that animals have emotions, and so that there's some continuum between animals and human beings. So I think that from a historical perspective, for the most part, we have thought that other animals are conscious.
So have we basically, just in terms of over history, how we've thought about animals, we've kind of gone back and forth in our thinking between they're conscious, they're not conscious, they're machines, they are conscious, they have emotions, they don't. Kind of go back and forth. Is that how it's been?
Yeah, well, I think predominantly we have thought of them as being conscious.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you think about those animal trials that occurred in Europe from the 13th century through to the 20th century. These were animals who were trialed for crimes against humanity, either for, you know, homicides or destruction of property. And these trials took place in continental Europe, so not in England, but, you know, across the continent. Also, even in the United States, I think there was a trial in early 20th century in the United States of an animal. And they were sort of treated as persons under the law, but it was assumed that they had intentionally committed these crimes. Whereas, you know, in England, they thought that animals couldn't intentionally harm people, you know, and so you could only hold their owners responsible for the crimes. But in Europe, they thought, no, the animals had done something wrong, so they should be tried. And they were given lawyers and they would argue their case. Then the animals were found guilty, exiled, hanged in some cases. And when they were hanged, they were often dressed up in little human clothing.
Wow.
People would bring their dogs and cats and donkeys along, just like, watch this, you know, you better behave,
learn this lesson,
or else you'll be next. But that all presupposed that people are thinking of these animals as capable, as conscious, as capable of forming intentions, and capable of kind of understanding their punishment as well.
Okay, we've covered a lot of animals today. I just want to do a rapid fire pick through a few more that people have very strong feelings about. If you could tell me what we know about their level of consciousness, that'd be great. Let's start with cockroaches. We've mentioned cockroaches a couple of times. What can we say about their level of consciousness?
Cockroaches have the basic neural architecture or circuitry.
Yep.
That flies have, that, you know, many arthropods have. And now it's well understood that, you know, that there's a selective attention mechanism in there where these cockroaches are paying attention to one thing and ignoring something else, and that they have the neural circuitry to be able to do that. So I would say that cockroaches are, you know, they have the rudiments of consciousness.
I'm still going to smash him.
Sorry. Basically, I'm asking because when I see a cockroach, I get it out of the way quickly. So should I feel really bad about
it? When I get a cockroach, my wife tells me to catch it and throw it outside.
So don't smash it.
Don't smash it.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I don't think they are conscious. If they are conscious, we should be able to sort of locate where the consciousness is. And we tend to think that that consciousness has to mediate behavior. But the trouble is you can ablate, like take out the brain of a cockroach and it'll still engage in escape behaviors. And you see these behaviors that we think are mediated by pain, for example. But, you know, you take out parts of the brain where you think that could, you know, is only reasonably could be, and they keep engaging in escape behaviors or grooming behaviors.
It might be a reflex rather than consciousness.
I think a lot of what cockroach does is can be explained just in terms of a reflex.
Okay,
can I just jump in there with the word reflex? We just use the word reflex for things that we do understand, right? So when we fully understand consciousness, it'll be potentially a bunch of reflexes. Right, so this is a difficult word, you know, the word reflex. It's something that we apply to a circuit that has been understood. And what we don't understand, we give a fancy word like consciousness or subjective awareness.
Okay.
But once we get there, some people will then say it's actually a very, very sophisticated reflex.
I feel like every question in this space like opens the door to a billion more questions. It's very hard to pin down. But okay, we'll put a pin on cockroaches for now. Elephants, they bury their dead. They're amazing. Are they conscious?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Surely.
Yeah. What about the animals we have the most contact with, our pets, our dogs and cats?
Well, they dream too, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Everybody is aware that their pets dream, right? So we see a dog pawing away in its sleep. We recognize behavior that we recognize in our own kids.
And emotions.
And emotions. And in a way, that's part of the problem, right? Because these are animals that, to some extent, look like us.
Mm.
And it's easy for us to imagine that they might have the similar thought processes or a consciousness. I would say that that's what's been kind of holding the field back, actually. We're looking for something similar to us, rather than really trying to understand the evolution of consciousness way back in time.
Well, I'm going to ask one more animal. chickens. A lot of us eat chickens. Are they conscious?
They're conscious.
Yeah. Well, the question that really underpins all of that is, like, you know, if animals are conscious, you come back to, should we be eating them? Should we be treating them better? And I guess maybe I'll get a show of hands from the audience here as well again. How many of you eat animals or animal products? Okay, most hands have gone up. How many of you are feeling, oh, my hand as well, yeah. Pretty angsty about that? Do you feel angsty about that? Hands up if you feel angsty. A little bit. I mean, I eat animal products and animals. I certainly would like for farming practices to be more humane. But is there a way to make peace with that decision, or do we just sort of have to live with the cognitive dissonance and maybe ignore that? Deb, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think there is some cognitive dissonance. If what we value about humans is our cognitive capabilities, or if, you know, we think it's wrong to cause pain, then obviously causing pain in anything else is should be wrong as well. You know, on the other hand, I don't think that pain is... first of all, I think there are many different kinds of harms. So whilst I don't think myself that there's enough evidence to establish that octopi are conscious, right, I think there are many reasons to not eat octopi. So, you know, there are many harms that aren't related to consciousness, right? So there's environmental reasons. You might have biodiversity reasons to not eat a certain kind of animal or whatever it might be. So you always have lots of reasons to not eat an animal, even if you decide that, you know, you don't have sufficient evidence to conclude they're conscious or not.
One thing I'm wondering is, you know, obviously there's a lot of room for improvement in the food system, but has what we've learned over the years about consciousness in animals changed how we treat them in science, in scientific study?
It has changed it tremendously. There's more push for research grants, for example, using animals that are simpler, for example, like fruit flies or insects, and not necessarily try to slaughter as many rats as possible for, you know, questionable research outputs. So there really is a push in the funding agencies to try to think carefully about what animals we're using, how we treat them, for example, how we euthanize them.
Mm.
This has all happened in the past 20 to 10 years. And also, there's almost no monkey research in Australia. And that's also a consequence, I think, of this way of thinking.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, like, so we won't test on monkeys in that same way now. We feel bad about whales being killed or dolphins, but we're not so fussed when like a mosquito or a fruit fly is swatted. Why do we make that distinction? Is it because of our perception of their levels of consciousness, or should there not really be a distinction there? Deb, do you have anything to say on that?
You know, with a lot of species that once you get beyond mammals, we lose that basis for, you know, for empathy or sympathy because they are so radically different from us. And I think that is a prejudice. I don't think that we should exclude the possibility of another mind on the basis of a radically different appearance to us. That, you know, that's just bad reasoning.
I guess to close off, we've covered a lot of ground, a lot of animals. If there's one question or idea or thought that you want to leave the audience with when it comes to thinking about animals and their consciousness, what would that be? Deb, maybe I'll start with you.
I guess, you know, science progresses by eliminating alternative hypotheses. And when, you know, as a scientist, I'm not a scientist, I'm a philosopher, but I know this much about scientists, that they never just generate one hypothesis. They always keep in mind the null hypothesis. So if you're generating a hypothesis that, you know, you think this animal, you know, feels pain or feels emotions or whatever it might be, you have to keep alive the alternative hypothesis that they don't. So we always have to sort of play devil's advocate with ourselves. And I think the animal consciousness is a debate at the moment where there's too little attention to the null hypothesis. You know, there's too much sort of jumping on the bandwagon of these creatures feel pain or those creatures feel pain. And nowadays, of course, there's a whole field of plant neurobiology where people are arguing that plants feel conscious and have memory and communicate and learn and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's a sort of slippery slope from there to panpsychism where everything is conscious, including this chair I'm sitting in.
Right.
So I think we need to explore and be curious, but we also, you know, need to keep alive the null hypothesis.
Yeah. Okay. Christina, are trees conscious? No, I'm joking. Your final thought or idea to leave the audience with?
I guess as we've seen through our conversation today, it's difficult to pin down definitions of things. But if we look at the history of, you know, scientists studying different animals around the world for the past 150, 200 years, I think one theme comes out, and that is we are consistently underestimating animals. And that's been convenient for us to be able to exploit them, to destroy their habitat, and to not care as much when species go extinct or whatnot. I think it's good to use the precautionary principle in our, you know, actions and decisions and policies toward animals. And I think, yeah, just if we can better live alongside them and from a conservation perspective, you know, enable these species to continue in the least.
Nice. All right, Bruno, final question or thought to leave the audience to think about.
I think it's a very exciting time about thinking about what is consciousness, how does it develop, how do we build it? You know, AI, when will it be conscious, right? This is really something that's going to be important in the next few years. And I think what's different about approaching consciousness, at least from my perspective, is it's not a top-down perspective, it's a bottom-up perspective. You know, how did it evolve? Which animals have active sleep and which animals don't have active sleep? Is that correlated in some way to their capacity to have a selective attention? Can you then imagine how consciousness may have evolved from what those animals have in common? And I think that's an interesting way of potentially imagining how consciousness may have been built through evolution to serve a purpose that was, you know, important for all animals. And then it doesn't end up being human consciousness. It's something that is important for every single species in its own way to have that.
That is Bruno Van Swindren, professor at the Queensland Brain Institute, closing off that chat.
Thank you all for being here.
You also heard from biologist and herpetologist and science communicator Christina Zdenek, as well as philosopher Professor Deborah Brown from the University of Queensland. This episode was recorded at the World Science Festival Brisbane. Thanks to the team there for programming this panel and to recording engineer Steve Fieldhouse. This episode was mixed by Tegan Nichols. It was presented by me, Sana Kadar. And that is it for All in the Mind this week. Thank you for listening. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.